So, we are in the middle of Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17, and we had some carryover questions from last time that I wanted to get to. We had talked about the division of the land between Ephraim and Manasseh, Manasseh being western Manasseh, and it raised a few questions. One, we had said that the reason why Manasseh is split between the eastern and western side of the Yarden, well, we gave a few different reasons for why they're split, but one of the reasons we suggested was that Manasseh's son Machir is credited with conquering the land on the eastern side of the Yarden. And since he conquered it, it's kind of you break it, you buy it type of a thing. So, no, that's his land. And we noted the arguments against that in general the wars were fought by the nation. And it wasn't as though you were automatically entitled to whatever piece of land you were victorious in. But that was one position that led to the question of, is Machir actually still alive? Because Machir is the son of, as we said, Manasseh. That would make him exceedingly old at this stage. So I did bring for you on your sheets the top source on the page, a comment from Ibn Ezra at the time of the conquest in Sefer Bamidbar. The Torah says Vayoresh es ha'emori asher sham, which is singular, and he conquered the Amori. So Ibn Ezra says, some say that in fact Machir was still alive, even though, you know, it really does seem very difficult. I mean, Tzlachad, right, is the son of Hefer, who is the son of Tzlachad ben Hefer ben Machir ben Menasheh, right? Tzlachad is the grandson, and he has daughters who are old enough to be debating in the Midbar about, you know, getting land and, you know, challenging Moshe and so on. Like, it's an awful lot of generations to have survived. So he says, some say it's Machir. Ulefi da'ati, but in my view, Shamilas Vayoresh Shava El Hagibor Shahayaba Mishpacha. He says, the word Vayoresh refers to the warrior. In other words, yes, it's singular, but it doesn't mean Machir. It means there was someone in the family who led the charge and conquered the Amori who are living in that area. But it's not Machir himself. So it's possible to argue that yes, it doesn't mean Machir personally conquered it. It's his clan that conquered it.
In which case, why would they choose to say him, not Manasseh, or not somebody else?
Because he's the one by whom the clan is identified. Why was he? But maybe because he was Manasseh's bechor. Families are funny that way, in terms of, you know, who they establish sort of as the patriarch of the family and the figure who, after generations, people are still going to remember, you know, as the one. The same thing, frankly, applies in matriarchy, you know, in terms of, you know, who people think of as sort of the head of the family is often determined by any number of circumstances. So, the second question that was asked was the question about the marriage of Benot Tzlachad and the problem of what happens when they marry. Because, generally speaking, right, we know the rule, the Torah assigns the Shevet identity to the male, right? Why does the Torah identify the Shevet with the male? We know it does. It calls like a Beit Av, right? But why?
But
why?
Land,
why is that? Sorry?
Didn't they get the land or the Yerusha or whatever on that side also?
Yeah, but still, what's the reason why this is all? And don't say it's because they're guys.
Are they because of 12 when the tribes, like if you married between, you would stay in the tribe?
Right, but again, but why is that so? So one of two ways to look at it. One is that the man is the one who is financially responsible for the family. He is the one who has to support everybody, and therefore everything is sort of in his name, because he's the one who has to take responsibility for it. And the other is because you're talking biblically. Exactly. Biblically, they have polygamy, right? Because it's not explicitly prohibited, therefore it is permitted, as opposed to polyandry, multiple husbands, which is not, right? Which goes back to the very first commandment in the Torah. Right? The first mitzvah that Hashem gives, aside from the specific one of don't eat that fruit, which, you know, didn't work out so well. But the first commandment that we have in the Torah is pruervu, right? To have children. In the event that you have a family in which there is more than one husband and one wife, that means you lock up all of the males for the period when she is pregnant nursing, right? And you limit the possibility of procreation. Whereas, if it's a family with one male and more than one wife, then it enables it. Granted that, the entire Tanakh may be read as a polemic against polygamy, because it never works, right? Every time they try it, there's always strife and trouble. But nonetheless, the Torah permits it because it allows for that. But now, if you have a situation in which a household may have more than one wife, and they could be from different tribes, then you have chaos if you say that the tribe is going to go by the mother. It has to go by the father, because you know there's one per family. So that's how you end up with this system. But the question is now, the daughters of Tzlafchad are inheriting land, right? So they get land from Menashe. And then they go off and marry somebody from Yehuda. That means that you're going to have little pockets of Menashe land that are now going to become Yehuda land. And not just them, because we know that after they ask the question, the rule is stated for everybody. Any case in which there are daughters and there are no sons, the daughters are going to be taking the land, and then, you know, through marriage, it will be, you'll end up with this kind of pockmarked map instead of the tribal identities that were considered to be very significant. So if you take a look in source number 2, I didn't bring a translation for it.
The land when they get married? They keep it?
Yeah.
Okay. So it goes to the other Shevet?
It'll go to the other Shevet, correct?
Definitely.
Well, their son, their kids, either their sons or their daughters, are going to inherit it. And there, and will be known by the tribe of the husband.
So they'll
be like Yehuda's land, but it's up here or whatever.
Right.
They have their father's land and their mother's land, the kids. So.
Right. And, but we have a hard enough time, like, remembering what the map is supposed to look like and who gets what. You know, now we're gonna have to deal with, you know, the fact that no, it's not at all. You just lose tribal identity, which very clearly is valued within the Torah. Right. It's a funny thing because I would have thought, with all the value we place on unity, we shouldn't be dividing up tribes. And remember that dividing up tribes was disastrous for us in the beginning. That's how we got the sale of Yosef. Right? Well, I'm from Leah, and you're from Rachel, and, you know, it all went from there. So the truth of the matter is, like, I'd be tempted to say, so do away with the tribes. But Hashem very clearly wants them. But you have the Medrash about how they cross through the sea and each tribe has its own spot. But you also have, just in the Psukim themselves, they camp by tribe as they're going through the Midbar. There's a sense of family trumping nation. And so this is your clan. And that's who you reside with. This is your part of the land. And there's a sense of real tribal identity. So take a look at source number 2.
Were women encouraged to marry within the tribe?
Take a look at number 2, please. You got it. This is from the very end of Sefer Bamidbar. It's generally speaking, people don't notice this, except for the last sentence, because they know they have to stand when it's read in shul. Vayikrevu Rashei Havaz. I apologize for not bringing the translation, but I wanted to fit everything on one page. Vayikrevu Rashei Havaz leMishpachas Bnei Gilad Ben Machir Ben Menashe miMishpachos Bnei Yosef. So the heads, Rashei Havaz, the heads of the families of Gilad, son of Machir, son of Menashe, from Yosef, they all come to Moshe. Vayidabru lifnei Moshe v'lifnei anasiim, and they speak before Moshe and the leaders of the tribes, Rashei Avos lifnei Yisrael, the heads of all the families. Vayomru, and they said, Es Adoni, that doesn't make this Shemos, Adoni means my master, it doesn't mean God. Es Adoni tziva Hashem, laseis ha'aretz b'nachala b'gara lifnei Yisrael. They say, look, Moshe, God told you to give out the land using this lottery to the Jews. And God told you that you should give Tzlafchad's portion to his daughters. Fine. But now, they are going to marry from among the tribes. And their portion will then be reduced from the portion of our fathers. It will be added instead to the portion to whom they marry, the portion of the tribe to whom they marry. And it will be lost from our lot. And then, when the Yovel year comes around, the Jubilee year, every 50 years, at which point land that has been sold reverts to its tribal identity. So when that happens, the new tribal identity is going to be the other tribe. At that point, it will all go over to that other tribe. And their portion will be lost from the tribe of our fathers. So that's their complaint to Moshe. We're at Pasuk Hey, it's the end of the fourth line. Vayitzah Moshe es b'nei Yisrael al pi Hashem lemor, kein matei b'nei Yosef dovarim, just like Hashem said regarding the daughters of Tzlachat initially. The language is very similar. It's very interesting. The beginning of Tzlachat's daughter's arrival is Vatikravna. And here it's Vayikravu. It's just male versus female, but it's the same language. And his response to the daughters of Tzlachat was, Kain b'noth Tzlachat dovros. So here, Kain matei b'nei Yosef dovrim. It's very clearly meant to be parallel to that language. So he says, yeah, it's true. Yosef is right. So this is what God says to the daughters of Tzlachat. Latov be'enehem tihyena l'nashim. They should marry whoever is good in their eyes. Ach l'mishpachas matei avihem tihyena l'nashim. But within their tribe. They should pick whoever they like, but within their tribe. And this way, the property won't go from tribe to tribe. Because this way, they will all stick to their tribes. And every daughter who inherits land from the tribes of Israel, so she will marry from her tribe. Leman Yershu b'nei Yisrael ish nachalas avosav, so that the Jews will each inherit the portion of their fathers. Velos yisov nachalam imatel matei acher, and yet the portion won't go from one tribe to another. Ki ish b'nachalaso yidbeku matos b'nei Yisrael, each one will stick to his tribe. And that's the instruction he gives. And then in Pasuk Yud, Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, kenasu b'nos slavchad. In fact, that's what they did. As Moshe instructed, so they did. They married their cousins. That's what they did. From the families of Menashe ben Yosef, so it's not first cousins, but people within Menashe in general. And so their portion remained within Menashe. And then the last pasuk, concluding the sefer. So that's the way that they compromise it. However, take a look at source number 3, the Gemara on this, and this is from the Gemara about Tu B'Av and the various reasons why we celebrate on Tu B'Av. Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Rav Yehuda says, quoting Shmuel, Tu B'Av was Yom Shehu Tru Shvatim Lavo Zeh Bo Zeh. That was the day when the tribes were permitted to marry each other. Meaning, this decree that Moshe gave was only for that generation, that they had to marry within the tribe. After that, in fact, they could marry out. Someone from Menashe, a woman from Menashe who inherited land, could marry someone from Naphtali, and yeah, the land's going to become Naphtali's land.
Cases of people yeah, why? Inheriting land were there?
We don't know anything. I mean,
only this one.
But we don't. We have nothing tracked to be aware.
Why would they change the rule?
So that's a really good question. Or I ask the question of why was it only for one generation? Just to complete the thought in the Gemara says, how do you know that it's only for that generation? This is what Hashem instructed the daughters of Tzlachad. So they play off of the word Zeh, Rashi says on this. It's the word Zeh, which is odd. He says, Davar Zeh lo yehenoeg ela bedor Zeh. It's only for Benot Tzlachad for their time. It's only for their generation, it's not later. So I ask, well, why would that be? I think the answer in a word is pragmatism. Pragmatism. It's a matter of practicality. Meaning that tribal identity is not easy to keep track of. You basically know Kohen/Levi is in Shevet Levi. You may know Yehuda, because it's a royal line. But other than that, it's a very hard thing to track. And in fact, look at what happens historically. Now, we have no idea. You know, unless you're Cohen Levi, we don't know.
Did both aspects only last? Like, did the fact that if you're a daughter and you want to inherit, did that also apply to the generation?
That stays.
You think that they were associated, and if one was dissolved, then another.
Yeah, nope. That rule stays. They still inherit, but they're not required to marry within their own shevet. It's a good thing, because I don't know how in the world we would manage this. On a simple level.
Well, now we don't have the land.
Right, we don't have the land at the moment.
At the time, they probably, since they lived in this area where everybody was their relatives in that area.
Right, I suppose early on, they would know. By the time you hit those who came back for the second Beis HaMikdash, it's not at all clear. It's a big mess, the issue of lineage, when they come out of Babel. So Yeah, I think on a practical level, it was kind of important that this was one generation. Granted that it could have survived longer than the first generation and been practical, eventually it would have fallen apart.
Maybe there's also a social function, like when they're in the meat bar and they don't have, you have no social structure, you're wandering around all the time, so you kind of need to have that organization of Shvachi. Maybe as you land, you come to the land, also they have to get settled after a generation. Geography can make for a kila. There's other ways of defining kila belonging, right. And maybe you don't have the need as much for a shevet and a sense of structure being imposed on you.
It's an interesting idea. Right? Could be that it's just not viewed as that important that you retain these kinds of rigid divisions. Maybe at a certain point it's just, okay, we gave each tribe its portion, but now we're going to federalize it, so to speak, and just say, you know, it will disintegrate. There are issues with saying that.
It makes more sense logistically anyway. Like, you're living there.
Yeah, maybe the border.
Other than that, you're not traveling.
Right. No, that's certainly true, but keep in mind, you would have strong populations near the borders. Many of the borders that we've seen there were big cities, but also many of the borders we've seen ran along bodies of water. And that's a natural place for communities to develop. So you had cities, and we talked about the removal of the cities that were absorbed in the borders. It's an interesting question. It's an interesting question on many levels. But that's, I want to note one other point. The Gemara Bava Basra in source number 4 is a little bit bothered because we read a verse that sort of contradicted itself. Right? The instruction that was given to them was, Latov Beinehem Tiel and Hashem, right? It was in Pasuk Vav in sentence 6, right? They should marry whoever's good in their eyes, but from their family. Yeah. So, which is it? So take a look at number 4. He says, I have news for you. This rule didn't even apply to the daughters of Slachad. It was any woman in their generation who was going to inherit would have this rule, except for the daughters of Slachad. They could marry whoever they wanted, because Shnemar, the Pasuk says, La tov beinehem tiyena l'nashim, they can marry whoever they choose. Elamani mekayim ach l'mishpachas matei avihem tiyena l'nashim, but then why does it say they have to marry the family of their fathers? So his answer is, Eitza tova hisiyan hakasuv shlo yinasu el lahagun lahen. So his resolution is, you're right, they do have to marry within their shevet. That's correct. However, it's giving them counsel saying, don't settle. The fact that we are prioritizing that it has to be within your shevet doesn't mean you just marry whoever's available within the shevet. The daughters of Tzlachat are viewed, as we saw last week, as meritorious, as righteous, as wise, and so on. So make sure that whoever you pick is going to be somebody who's good for you within the shevet. Don't make the only criteria that his last name is Menashe, so to speak. That's the way that he reads it. But it's a problem. And I could actually see another way to conclude the Gemara, but I think that's the answer the Gemara is giving here.
Is this Pasuk where they're allowed to choose whom they want? Is it used anywhere as a precedent for not having parents make shidduchim, but having women be allowed to? How did this come down through the ages?
Well, the same thing would be true regarding males. In other words, when parents make shidduchim, the male is just as powerless as the female. The issue isn't, but in terms
they are
of
supposed to agree, aren't they? I mean, the
yeah, no. If they don't agree, it doesn't happen. That's true. In terms of the arranged system in general, Tosfos in Kiddushin discusses the history of the arranged system and says this was not what was supposed to happen. In Tosfos' time, so you're talking about 12th, 13th century Western Europe, he says the reason why they were arranging marriages for minors at that point, saying, you know, we're going to arrange it now and then they'll get married, was because families didn't know what their fortunes were going to be. This is the period of the Crusades. And who knows? They have money right now, but who knows what they have a year from now. So if they had the ability, they would make the arrangement now. And he says it was a bidyevet. It wasn't considered good. And he notes in the Gemara itself says, Asr la'adam l'kadesh isha, I'm blanking on the next two words exactly, but something like, a man is not allowed to marry a woman without having seen her first. That's the Gemara's statement. But in the arranged system, believe it or not, like that could happen. But it wasn't the way it was supposed to be done. It was a concession to a reality. You know, which system works better and has better results, I'm going to leave for the sociologists to discuss. Yeah. So that's in terms of that question of just the marriage issues for the daughters of Tzlalcha. The other holdover question was the question of what in the world happened with this. Is this a change? Why doesn't Moshe handle the case? Why didn't Moshe tell them this rule from the beginning? Right? Why does this wait for the daughters of Tzlalcha? Why is it that this plays out the way that it does in the Torah? So last week I gave some answers, but I wanted to show you four different approaches. The first approach is the one that I mentioned last week. If you flip the page to source number... why is it there? No, sorry, source number 5. Not number 8. Number 5. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Ches, which says... Ru'uya parshas nachlos shetikasev al yidei Moshe Rabbeinu. The portion of the portions of land really should have been written via Moshe. It should have been, as part of the laws of inheritance. Ela shezachu benos Tzlalchad v'nichtav al yadan. But they were meritorious, the daughters of Tzlalchad, and therefore it was written at their hand. Hashem said, you know what? They're going to be, you have to work with sort of, kind of Back to the Future type of an approach here, because they only show up after Moshe has taught the laws of inheritance. But God knows that they're going to do this, and he says, I want them to have the opportunity. I want them to be the ones. So the Gemara then says, you should know, it isn't only a positive. Sometimes that happens to the negative. Ru'uya ha'isa parshas mekoshesh shetikase v'ayidei Moshe Rabbeinu. The story of the mekoshesh, the wood gatherer, the fellow who's gathering wood on Shabbos and is brought to Moshe, and Moshe says, let me go ask God what we do. So that also should have been written by Moshe with the laws of Shabbos. But, shenischayev mekoshesh v'nechtava yado, this wood gatherer was liable, and therefore it was written at his hand. L'lamdecha teaches you, shemegalgu l'chova yidei chayev uzchus ayidei zakai. Sometimes if someone is bad, someone is liable, so we bring liability for the liable. Someone is good, we bring merit for the righteous. That's one approach. Second approach, which I mentioned also a little bit last time, is that Moshe forgot the law. He forgot it. What do you mean Moshe forgot it? So take a look at source number 6. In the beginning of Sefer Devarim, we get the repetition of many events from the Midbar, including the appointment of the judges. And if you remember the way the judges were appointed, right, Yisro says to Moshe, it's too much, if you're going to do all this all day long, it's bad for the nation, appoint people beneath you and you'll delegate to them. And so there are officers in charge of groups of 10 and officers in charge of groups of 50, and how that structure worked is interesting in its own right. But the bottom line is, you end up with a judicial system in which there are courts, and people can go to the lower courts, and if the lower court doesn't know, then they go ask the higher one all the way up to Moshe. And Moshe tells them, whatever is too difficult for you, takrivun elai ushmativ, bring it to me, and I will hear it. So Rashi says in source number 6, takrivun elai, bring it to me, al davar zeh nistalek mimenu mishpat binos tzlachad. That's why Moshe forgot the law of Benos Tzlachad. Meaning, Hashem was punishing him. Because it's arrogant for you to say, bring it to me. Too hard for you. I'll take care of it. So therefore, Moshe gets zapped. Hashem says, I'll show you. They're going to bring you something, and you aren't going to actually know the answer. This is a difficult line. Rashi is not making it up. It's a Medrash Tanchuma. The reason why it's difficult, though, is because the Gemara in Sanhedrin that we saw in source number 5 also brings this as a possibility. The Gemara there asks the question of, hey, why didn't Moshe teach this law? And the Gemara suggests maybe it's because he was being punished for saying Takrivun Elai Ushmativ. However, that same section there in the Torah has Moshe say explicitly, I don't know everything, but I will learn from God. So Moshe didn't express himself arrogantly. So the idea exists that this was a punishment, but it's a hard idea to accept. I think there's a reason why the Gemara does this. Take a look at number 6 again, please. There's a word there that may explain why they make the association between this and the daughters of Tzlalchad. And I've called attention to this word already today, so maybe you'll catch it. Takrivun. Sorry, not the Z. Moshe says, whatever is too hard for you, takrivun elai, and when the daughters of Tzlalchad come to him, it's vatikravna. So it's, you know, it does seem like there's a parallel there. Like you said, Takrivune Lai. Well, we're going to try it and see what happens. That, I think, is what the Medrash is picking up on. But that's the second possibility. The first possibility is that God withheld the information from Moshe because he wanted the daughters of Tzlachat to have the chance. Second possibility is God zaps Moshe's brain and makes him forget it. Happens to us all the time. It's not my fault. God did it. And then a third answer is that this case had a unique complication. You remember we spent time last week trying to figure out which land they got? And we said they had four different portions because there were 10 portions of land and there were six other families and whatever. And we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what in the world that meant. We'll take a look at number 7. Gemara Bava Basra. Yodeya haya Moshe Rabbeinu Shebenos Tzlachat Yorshoshein. Moshe knew that the daughters of Tzlachat inherit. What he didn't know is, do they get the firstborn portion, meaning the one that their father, Tzlachat, had a right to, that we said was one of the four portions they got. That's what he didn't know. And really, the portion of inheritance, the idea that women inherit at all, should have been written by Moshe, but that went to the daughters of Tzlachat, as we said in number 5, because they were righteous. So therefore they got it. But the idea that Moshe needs to go to God is not he doesn't know the law, it's that he doesn't know the specifics of their case. Their case was more complicated.
Can't you say, like here, that explanation, the first one that said he didn't know it and he was being punished, that really puts him in a bad light, but can't you just say it the opposite? Look at what an anav he was. They came to him and he said, I'm going to need to ask God. Can't
Good.
We pose this in a positive way?
Right. Sora offers the fourth answer. I mean, take a look at source number 8. Medrash in Bamidbar Rabba. Which is odd that it's in Bamidbar Rabba, because the name that's tacked onto it is Reish Lakish. Yeah. Reish Lakish is not a Tana, he's an Amora. It's the flip side of the same page.
Yeah, but you know what? I've got my...
Okay. So, Reish Lakish Omer.
Okay.
Yodeya haya Moshe Rabbeinu es hadin hazeh. He says, Moshe knew the law. But what happened was, the daughters of Tzlachat went to the lowest level court first, right? Just like they're supposed to do. They went to the municipal whatever, the ones who were in charge of 10. Amru, and they said, oh, this is way above us. Din shel nachlos hu, a matter of inheritance. That's not our jurisdiction. Vein zeh shelanu, ela shel gedola mimenu. That belongs with greater authorities, broader authorities. So Bawe Tel Sari Hamishim, they come to the heads of 50s. Rosh Kibdu Osun Sariya Saros. They look and see that the lower level officers have given them honor. And Amru Sari Hamishim, so they said, Av Anu Yeshem Gedolim Mimenu. We also have greater people we should be referring this to. Vechen Lasari Meos, and so it went up to the hundreds. Vechen Lasari Alafim, and so do to the thousands. Vechen Lanesim, and it goes up all the way to the heads of the Shvatim. And Yeshivu Lem Kulam Kenyan Hazeh. They all give the same answer. They don't want to be the ones to assess this case when there are those who are greater than them. So they go to Elazar. Amar Lam Hari Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Elazar at this stage has taken over as the Kohen Gadol. Aharon is gone. So he says, go to Moshe. Bo Elu Ve'elu Lifnei Moshe. So everybody shows up at Moshe's doorstep. And Moshe sees that each level in the hierarchy has shown respect to the greater one and said, well, who am I? Go to him. Amar im omar lahemes hadin et olas hagidula. He said, if I do this, if I tell them, then it looks like I'm saying I am great and, you know, I deserve all of this honor that they all send it to me. So instead, Amar lahem af ani yesh gadol mimeni. He said, actually, I have a superior also. And so Moshe brought their case to God. In other words, as Ezra said, maybe he did it as a matter of humility. Now, there's a problem with that answer.
Everything that comes up to him is going to help him answer any question.
Right. Well, you will end up...
not a very efficient system. Maybe you have to tell your
Right, I mean, the system is going to fall apart. It's going to defeat what you were trying to do in the first place. Your whole point was that you don't want Moshe handling all the cases. But now, as a matter of humility, you know, everyone's going to kick it upstairs. You're going to have a serious logjam in your judicial system.
For a lot of the other stuff, there was precedent already. So, law only court could rule on it for people because Moshe had ruled over the years.
But then anything that got up to the Moshe level, he was going to ask God.
They're saying they're doing it because they have someone greater than them, not necessarily that they didn't know the answer.
You also don't necessarily...
Well, they didn't know the answer. So they didn't want to answer it because they didn't know the answer.
Maybe they were afraid of the precedent.
Right, so first of all, you don't have precedent.
No, but something...
Right,
but they didn't want to set it for
No, but... You don't have you don't have precedent. We set this up. This system is set up before Sinai. There's no applying for precedent. Yeah.
There's no precedent.
But also, you notice that the first group that kicked it upstairs said, well, this is a matter of inheritance. You know, this is about nachala. It really is, so to speak, federal rather than state. Or to use Canadian, I don't know, federal than province or something. It's not. I knew that.
Didn't you take your citizenship?
Absolutely not. And I don't think that would have been the difference, unfortunately. In terms of what's going on here, it could really be that they only do it because of the significance of the matter. But the problem is still, if we're going to have a judicial system in which our judges are too humble, then we're not going to be able to deal with the needs of the nation. And take a look at number 9, which is, I think, the driving thought behind this this medrash. Medrash on Shir HaShirim. Medrash on Shir HaShirim, I believe, is significantly later in its canonization than the Midrashim in Bamidbar Rabbah. But look at what it says. This is from when Moshe dies. Hashem tells Moshe, go up to Har Ha'avarim, and also identifies it as Har Nevo. So this is right after the story with the daughters of Tzlachad, that Moshe is told to do this. He is told to divide up the land properly, and we get this, he's then told to go up, and then he tells Hashem who he wants to take over after he dies, and so on. So, Aleh Har Ha'avarim Hazeh Har Nevo, ascend to this Har Ha'avarim Har Nevo. V'chima Inyan Hazeh Lazeh. What's the connection between these events, meaning daughters of Tzlachad and Moshe's death? Kevan de'ispalgas ara, once the division of the land was done or discussed, the daughters of Tzlachad came to Moshe to take their shares. V'nistalek Moshe midinan, and Moshe said, I can't answer the question. As the text says, Moshe brought their case to God. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to which Hashem replied, Moshe, midinan at mistalek, umilfanai ein at mistalek. He says, Moshe, you withdraw from their case and not from me. In other words, this is wrong. You're not supposed to withdraw from a case. When you say, I'm not going to judge it, what you're doing is abdicating. And so God says to Moshe, that's it. Aleh al Har Ha'avarim Hazeh. Time for you to go up to Har Ha'avarim. We need new leadership. You can't have a situation in which the leader says, I can't address the case that's in front of me. Now, this is an odd medrash in the sense that we have a general understanding that Moshe dies because of something relating to hitting the rock. Maybe this has to do with the timing of when he would die. Perhaps that's why. But nonetheless, the medrash is saying here, maybe even though what Moshe did was a gesture of humility to go to God, that may not have been the right thing to do. That's the. I think that's what you're seeing here.
If he wouldn't, then it wouldn't have been in their merit.
Well, this is taking a different tack. That it wasn't about their merit, it was about humility from Moshe.
Right.
So we have 4 different answers to the brief question that was asked at the end last time. We have the answer that it was for their merit. We have the answer that Moshe was made to forget it. We have the answer that Moshe didn't know a nuance of their case. And we have the answer that Moshe was being humble. And that's why he referred it to God. The other difficulty with the humility answer is that it doesn't explain why, when the laws were written down of inheritance, when Moshe presented it, he didn't say anything about the daughters. In other words, if this was really the law, and he didn't know the daughters of Tzlachad were going to show up at his doorstep, why wasn't that written into the set of laws that he gave everybody? And this wouldn't even have been a discussion. Unless you're going to say that Hashem says, you know what, you said it originally. Well, no, because if he said it originally, then they wouldn't have come to him. Yeah, I'm not sure how to resolve that problem, actually. You follow the problem. I'm not sure how to deal with that one. Okay. That's fine. That brings us to the last part of this chapter. Psukim Yud Dalet to Yud Ches, sentences 14 to 18. And this is a very interesting situation. you never want to be, as a leader, you never want to be in a situation in which there is a need for your people, your family, your tribe, to get some kind of a special favor, and they come to you and ask for it. But that's exactly what happens to Yehoshua. Yehoshua is from Ephraim, right? Yehoshua is from Ephraim. So with Yehoshua being from Ephraim, watch what happens. Vayidabru b'nei Yosef, right? Chapter 17, sentence 14. Vayidabru b'nei Yosef es Yehoshua lemor. The children of Yosef. I don't know exactly who that is. Menashe, Ephraim, both of them we'll have to see. But the children of Yosef come to Yehoshua and they say, Madua nasatali nachala goral echad v'chevel echad. Why did you give me my portion as one lot, one segment? Taking chevel to mean a segment. Chevel is a term used for a measuring rope, like you use when you survey land. Vani amrav. There are a lot of us. Ad asher ad ko birchani Hashem, which is a funny phrase. Ad asher ad ko birchani Hashem. I see different translations around the table. I'm curious to see what we have. Yeah, basically. But it's ad asher ad ko. There's a double ad.
Seeing that I am a numerous people.
That is a cop-out.
No, the, to such an extent. Shall bless me to such an extent.
What's that? Say, what does it say?
Yeah, question. Here it says, seeing I'm a great people.
Seeing I'm a great people. No, but what is the whole clause? After Chevel.
Numerous people. For Hashem has blessed me. So, they
co-with Berkhani.
Right. Vani Amrav ad asher ad co-Berkhani Hashem. I still don't know what to do with the two ads.
For as much as.
Right. For as much is probably one word there too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's not a word. There's a question mark?
It says, when I am a great people, since the Lord has blessed me so much.
Oh, because that's the whole thing is a question. It began with, why did you give me?
Why has thou given me?
Yeah.
I don't even understand the question, because Bnei said, I understand they didn't get only one portion.
Right.
Menashe got massive amounts of land, and Ephraim, you could argue they have three portions, Menashe East, Menashe West, and
Ephraim.
Is it Bnei Yosef, both of them, or one of them?
So, right, so we need to know who is complaining, and what do they mean when they say that they only got one share? Someone's angry, but I don't know who.
In fact, Yosef got two shares, all the other tribes only got one share, and Yosef's the one who got two shares, actually.
Right. Right. In effect, they're actually getting more. Just from a numerical perspective, to make sure that we realize when we say they're a great nation, Menashe is overlarge. Not overlarge. Menashe is large, and Ephraim is actually small. The way it works is a very interesting thing. Most of the tribes, but you have two censuses. One in year one, and one in year 40. Or one is year 2, one is year 40. The one in year 1, year 2 is found in the very beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. That's, we think, how the book gets the name Numbers, right, from that initial census. And then the other one is Bamidbar Chavav, which is already year 40. So in between, most of the tribes don't really change all that much. Reuven goes from 46,500 to 43,730. They drop, but not by much. Levi goes from 22,000 to 23,000. Yehuda goes 74,600 to 76,500. They're basically steady. There are a couple of them, though, that do change drastically. Shimon goes from 59,300 down to 22,200. Right, and remember, well, that we have to find out what happened to Shimon. But keep in mind, the anger against Shimon and Levi from Yaakov, right? And Levi may be protected by the fact that they don't worship the golden calf, and they, you know, become dedicated to God. But Shimon drops drastically. We'll have to talk more about what happens to Shimon.
During those 40 years, well, they all died out, though, didn't they?
Well, there's a new generation that's born.
Right. But the new generation wasn't this big.
But this is calamitous. They lost more than 50% of their population. And the other tribes don't see the only. So that's one case of dramatic difference. The next case of dramatic difference is Menashe. Menashe goes from 32,200, which put it at, you know, towards the bottom of the tribes, to 52,700, which puts it a little bit above average, I think. So they have this dramatic growth. And they will be justified, perhaps, in complaining. Because there's a lot of discussion, I hinted at it when we talked about the division of the land back in chapter 14. There's a lot of discussion about whether the land is divided based on the numbers from when they left Egypt and the number of families they had then, or whether it's based on those who enter the land or some combination thereof. So if it's done based on those who left Egypt, and Menashe says, well, back then there were only 32,000 of us, but now there are 52,000 of us, we can't go based on that original census. It's not right. So that could be their complaint. Yeah, this is true.
Why? Why did they get that?
So that was last time, right?
No, why did they get Abrahariden? Why did they also get?
So they got Abrahariden on the east side because they're protectors and they're, you know, guardians and so forth. So the answer may be because the land on the east side isn't sufficient, or because they never asked to be out of the land of Israel. You know, they didn't want to be outside. And granted that the east side has some quasi-status, you know, as we discussed, I don't remember when, it has some status as Eretz Yisrael. It's very clear that it's not considered core, just for the fact that Moshe is buried there and he's told you can't enter the land. So, you know, they'll say, we didn't intend to sacrifice what we get in Israel for what is on the eastern side. The other one that does change is Ephraim. And it is a substantive change. Ephraim starts out at 40,500 and drops down to 32,500. So that's a significant change. I mean, you talk about 20% loss. So keep that in mind, that Menashe grows a lot and Ephraim drops a lot. And that may relate to this. We'll have to see. So someone's complaining to Yehoshua, saying, hey, God has blessed us a lot. Presumably, that has to be Menashe. Ephraim cannot say we've been blessed to have grown, because the opposite is true. And so, look at the answer that Yoshua gives in Pasuk Tesvav, sentence 15. Vayomer Alehem, Vayomer Alehem Yoshua, Yoshua said to them, Im Am Rav Ata, Alelecha Hayara, if you are really many, go up into the forest, and clear it for yourself, in the land of the Prizi, the land of the Rephaim. Rephaim are supposed to be mighty, oversized Canaanim, because Mount Ephraim is too small for you. Now, Mount Ephraim makes it sound like we're talking about Ephraim, but hold the question. Vayamru b'nei Yosef, so these children of Yosef, whoever they are, say back, Lo yimatse lanu hahar. The mountain, no, that's not going to cut it for us, meaning it's not sufficient, it sounds like, for us. Verechav barzel b'chol haknani hayoshev be'eretz ha'emek. Not only that, but there's also another problem. In the valley around that mountain, you have these Canaanites, and they have iron chariots. The Canaanite who are in Beit Sha'an and the area around it, v'la'asher be'emek Yisrael, and those who are in Emek Yisrael. So we have two problems. Number one, the mountain isn't big enough for us. It's not going to suit our needs. And number two, the Canaanite are not going to go so easily. So in Pasuk Yizayin, sentence 17, Vayomer Yoshua el Beis Yosef, Yoshua says to the house of Yosef, Le Ephraim v'le Menashe. Now we specify, he speaks to Menashe and Ephraim. Le more, saying, Im Rav Ata, if there are so many of you, what did I say, Im? Sorry. Am Rav Ata, you are many, V'choach Gadol Lach, you have a lot of strength, Lo Yelacha Gorol Echad, you aren't going to have only one portion, Kihar Yiyalach, you're going to have a mountain. Kiyaru, it's a forest. Uvere so, clear the forest. V'hayalacha totz osav, and you will also have all the areas around it. Kisarisha Saknani, because you will conquer the Kanani. Kirechav Barzelo, who have these iron chariots. Kichazaku, they're strong. You're strong. And even though they're strong, you'll be able to defeat them. And that's Yeshua's answer. In other words, his answer is, nothing doing. You know, deal with it.
Yeah.
That's Yoshua's answer, it seems. So what is going on in this story? Who is complaining? What are they complaining about? What can we understand here? It's too bad we're not going to get to chapter 18. There's a remarkable thing there, too, but we'll get to that eventually, God willing. But let's start with who it is who makes the request. So, first of all, we have a problem in the fact that it's B'nai Yosef, and then suddenly we mention Ephraim and Menashe. It's also a problem because, as we've said, if both of them are complaining, then why do we say they got goral echad, one lot? They actually had separate portions, if not three. And if it's Ephraim complaining, as we said, they shrunk. And if it's either of them alone, let's say it's just Menashe complaining. What are you complaining? Everyone got goral echad. Did you expect you were going to get more than goral echad? And not to mention you have land on the eastern side of the Yarden. So two basic approaches. One is the approach of the world, and the other is the approach of Ralbag. Those who were here last year may be surprised that Abarbanel wasn't on the other side, but he's not. So Rashi, Radak, Abarbanel, all the classic commentators say that it's the group from Menashe who are on the western side of the Yarden. That's the group that is upset. What's wrong with getting one portion? So Rashi and Radak say that they said one portion because each tribal portion was equal. Remember that we've had a debate, which we're going to come back to again in chapter 18, about how the lottery works. Because on the one hand, the Torah says, give larger tribes larger portions, smaller tribes smaller portions. And then on the other hand, the Torah also says that it's supposed to be done by lottery. So you don't get to decide who's getting what. So you know, that's a problem in and of itself in terms of how that works. So, you know, again, we're going to have to go through this, and we'll see it again in chapter 18. But basically, most commentators believe, most commentators whose name is not Abarbanel, believe that the lots were equal portions. They were not larger and smaller. Abarbanel says that the lottery just did regions, and then, based on the needs of the tribe, they gave everybody what they needed. But everybody else, almost everybody else, says that the portions involved are equal portions, and then either they gerrymander the lines a little bit once they decide who's going to be where to fit their needs, or each tribe compensated the other financially based on, you know, if they got something that maybe the other one should have gotten. Different answers, which again we're going to come back to in the next chapter, but the point is Rashi and Radak say when they say one portion that we're upset we're getting one portion, they mean each tribal portion is equal and it's based on those who left Egypt, and therefore we are out of luck. That's the concern that they're voicing, and that it's really Menashe who's upset. And as evidence, they note that this section mentions the mountain and Beit Sha'an, which are in Menashe. And Rashi adds a funny note on this. If you take a look on your sheets, you want source number 10. Rashi tries to give us some way to read that line with the ko in it. He says, Ra'isa shenisraba minyani miminyan rishon leminyan sheni esrim elav v'chamesh meos kiminyan ko bigamatria. He says, Menashe says to Yoshua, our numbers went up from the first census to the second census by 20,500, which is like ko in gematria, because ko, kaf, hey, the letter kaf is 20, and the letter hey is 5. So it's like 20,500. They're hinting at the way the census went up. That's a very interesting approach. Davar Acher, look, the numbers work. Davar Acher, alternatively, he says, it's a different code. Hashem gives a bracha to Abraham at Bris Ben Abisarim, the covenant between the pieces, when he says, ko, exactly, ko yezaracha, right? Look up at the stars and so on, so will be your children. So that's the bracha. Ko is a bracha of growth. So Ad Asher Ad Ko, Bracha Namra la Abraham ko yezaracha niskaima bi. The bracha that Hashem gave to Abraham, that your children will spread and multiply, yeah, that's the bracha that was fulfilled with me. Ulefi pshuto, and then he says the simple read is, ad asher ad ko, ad asher kach, to the point where it is like this, kasher ad taro el, look at us, we're just too big. So, it's Menashe complaining. Then why does Ephraim get mentioned in Pasuk Yud Zayin? Why throw in Ephraim then? Why do you speak to Ephraim also? So sorry?
You got the double portion. So like, what are you talking about? Your tribe got more than anybody else.
Maybe they'll help each other with the conquering?
Right. So Yoshua's advice, one approach is that he's just telling them, team up with Ephraim.
That's Menashe so warriors. I
mean, right, those are on the eastern side. Those are the warriors. The ones who are left on the other side are the other ones who are not.
If he wasn't on my sam, one went up, share?
No, he's saying team up to battle the Canaan in the area. Alternatively, Abarbanel suggests that actually you have to read the complaint a little bit differently. If you go back to the sentences themselves, in 14 it's Menashe talking. You gave us one portion, it's too small, we can't deal with this. Yoshua in Pasuk Tedvav, in sentence 15, comes back and says, there are many of you, clear the mountain, you can do it. In Tetzayin, he says in 16, it's Menashe and Ephraim at that point. And they say, Lo Yimatse Lanu Hahar, it's not going to work for us. And by the way, there are these chariots, and therefore Ephraim chimed in, and that's what leads Yoshua to respond to both of them. So that's another way to look at it in terms of why Ephraim makes it into it. But that's one approach. One approach is Menashe is the one who complains. Ralbag, I think, and I think there's more than one way to read Ralbag, but Ralbag seems to say that no, actually, Menashe and Ephraim get one portion. If you take a look at source number 11, he says, V'hine zachar shenachlas b'nei Yosef ba'a yachad. He says, the text mentioned that the portions of the sons of Yosef were assigned together. So it was such that it was included in the boundaries of others as this is Yosef's region. That's one approach. Alternatively, it just meant we have a confined portion, meaning that we can't expand. There's no room for us to be able to get more land, and we need it. There's more to say about Ralbag, but the basic approach I think I would go with, if you have to remember what chapter 17 talk about, and you got through the Bnos Slavchad and the land of Menashe, I think this is really, as most of the commentators say, it's Menashe complaining fundamentally. It's Menashe saying, this is simply too small. And Yoshua says, you can do it. You are able to take the clear the forest. You're able to conquer the mountain. And as Radak says, this will give you some of Ephraim's land. Take a look at number 12, please. He says, Tichros yar ha-prizivah ha-refaim. You're going to cut down this forest where the prizia and the refaim are hiding. V'yelechahara huli yishuv. You'll be able to settle the mountain. V'tarchiv bo nachalascha. And you will broaden your share that way. And then, Biritzon b'nei Ephraim. It will be with the agreement of Ephraim. Ki hem yisratzu bazeh. They're going to be happy too. Ki tov lahem shiyiyah yishuv mishiyiyah yar. They'll be happier with settled land as opposed to a forest with the Kanani and the Prizi living there. So, yes, you're going to essentially shuffle things a little bit on the border, and that's how you're going to, and that's how you're going to thrive. So Menashe complained. Yoshua said there's this border territory between you and Ephraim. You can take that area, and then everybody will be happy. At which point they came back to Yoshua in sentence 16, and they said, that's not going to be enough, and there is the matter of the iron chariots. What are we going to do with the iron chariots? Now that pasuk is a little bit difficult, because iron chariots are not very helpful on a mountain. What are you worried about? They're not fighting you with iron chariots on the mountains. When you want to take the mountain, you'll be just fine. They even said the chariots are in the valley around. So take a look at what Malbim does in source number 13. He answers the problem. He says, "V'rechav barzel b'chol haKenani hayoshev ba'emek." There are iron chariots among the Kenani who dwell in the valley. Acharei haharahu, behind the mountain, beyond the mountain. V'tov yiyah hayar mechitza beinenu uveinam. What we want is to leave the forest in place as a buffer zone between us and them. Because otherwise they're going to ascend and then they're going to destroy the land on the other side, past the mountain. We wanted to leave the forest in place as a buffer zone. That's what we were hoping to do, is their response to Yoshua, because we're worried about these chariots of theirs. To which Yoshua replies in sentence 17, come on, there are a lot of you. You're really strong. You're not going to have one confined space. You'll be able to take this area. And you will conquer the Kanani. And yeah, they're mighty. But fundamentally, as Rashi says, I brought in a number 14, you have the ability uniquely to do this. Other tribes couldn't do this. You have the ability to fight them and win.
Is it only Chatzi Shevet Menashe?
Yes. It is only Chatzi. We don't know the percentages. We just know, we had said last time, the ones on the eastern side are the ones who are the warriors. That's one of the reasons given for why they're there. But we don't know the percentage of who ended up where.
Weren't they not supposed to leave to go back until the land was conquered?
Correct. Wait and see. Mm-hmm. You're right, but if you look in the beginning of Perek Yudchet, you'll already see that they ended up leaving without the land being fully conquered. They end up dividing up the land without having taken it all. And that's
right.
What sets up like all of Sefer Shoftim.
Right.
So what we've seen...
So now you're dividing it up, they were supposed to help them conquer it. So you could divide it up, it's still then help them finish.
Right, so I think not. And you'll see, after 14 years, they're gone.
It's 14 years.
Well, they obviously
it's 7 years of conquest
side.
And then 7 years of dividing everything up.
On the other side,
that
for 14
yeah,
years.
Wow.
Who was unhappy? Which side?
I don't know.
The,
I don't know. That's right. There's
a valid
that's
yeah.
Right.
The,
there's a right. Right. That would actually make sense yeah. From an Asha.
No, the Gibeah numbers happened in the Midbar. Oh. And it was right.
Again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the, down after that?
We don't know. We don't get another census. So, in terms of what we've seen here, we answered the questions from last time. We said Machir was not necessarily the conqueror of Gilad. It could have been the family. We explained the rules of marriage for the daughters of Tzlachad in order to prevent land from going from Shevet to Shevet, and noted that it seems to stop after that generation, and gave four different answers for why Moshe doesn't handle the case. Tzlachad, the merit of the daughters of Tzlachad, or Moshe forgetting, which we said was a difficult answer. It was an odd answer. Moshe not knowing a certain detail of the case, now that he didn't know the case in general. And then the answer that it was kicked upstairs to Moshe, and Moshe in his humility passed it along as well, which may not have been the right thing to do. We then get Yosef, meaning Menashe, it appears, requesting more land, being uncomfortable with the narrow space that they have. Yoshua says, take the forest and the mountain on the border with Ephraim. Menashe says, we need that as a boundary between us and these dangerous Prizi on the other side. Sometimes they're called Prizi, sometimes they're called Kanani. And Yoshua answers, you're big boys, you can do it. And that's what he sends them to do. Abarbanel notes, Menashe doesn't answer. Yoshua gets the last word. Either they were satisfied, or they saw that they weren't getting anywhere. But either way, Yoshua ends the discussion. So what happens next week, God willing, is we move on to the other seven tribes. Meaning, we spent a lot of time on Yehuda, on Ephraim, and on Menashe. Next one is going to say, so what happens to the other tribes? We're going to spend some time on Binyamin, and then we have like one chapter that's going to deal with everybody else. So we're getting towards the end of the division of the land. Thank you very much.